It's Sunday morning. Time for the Great Outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. A couple weeks ago, I talked about being in the incredible experience of the Tracy's Arm of South Sawyer Glacier, south of Juneau, about 50 miles in a small boat, and then getting into which had been our mothership, if you will, for the week I was in that part of Alaska, and then getting into a small Zodiac and motoring through the glacier, through the icebergs, coming up to within, oh, I'd say 100 yards of the glacier, and having this majestic glacier above you, and what it was like, and also to jump in the water and have a real awakening. I jumped in the water voluntarily. So that was on a Tuesday, and the world was beautiful. This tells you just how fast things in nature can change. Sunday morning at 5:30 in the morning, a large part of South Sawyer Glacier collapsed and created a 100-foot tall tidal wave, where I and a handful of other boats were playing in the waters, looking at seals, looking at all kinds of bird life, looking at the glaciers calving, literally reaching out of our Zodiac and touching icebergs which had just come off the glacier. A landslide glacier of epic proportions changed that world forever. And had I been there 5 days later, I wouldn't be talking to you today. And it kind of shocks me from the point of view of how quickly nature can change. There's been a series of earthquakes off the coast of Alaska during the course of this summer, and there were aftershocks. And what people believe happened is the aftershocks caused some of the loose rock sedimentation to break loose, and that caused a big part of the glacier to cascade down. And at 5:32 a.m., it came crashing down, and that 100-foot tidal wave then moved its way out Tracy's Arm and out into Stevens Passage and all the way up towards Juneau, bringing 20-foot swells when it got to Juneau. So think about this for a moment. If this had been at 10 o'clock in the morning, let's say, there could well be hundreds of people dead, because what happens is nobody spends the night at the mouth of the glacier, or right at the face of the glacier. First of all, the water is about 300 feet deep. But second of all, it's really cold. And also, I guess, it can be dangerous with calving glaciers. So people spend the night out in Stevens Passage and other bays. So there was not a single boat at 5:30 in the morning in Tracy's Arm. If there has been, I mean, even one of those massive cruise liners that can have thousands of people on board, if it had been in Tracy's Arm and a 100-foot tidal wave came at them, that ship would not survive. So it just sends chills up your spine to realize how fragile life is. And the story of the collapsing glacier was told by three kayakers, three very experienced wilderness kayakers who had been working their way up through southeast Alaska and were going to end up in Glacier Bay. They had already been kayaking for something like 80-plus days, and they had another 60 to go. And they camped out towards the mouth of Tracy's Arm, and they left their kayaks down at the water level. But being experienced campers, they for some reason knew, I wouldn't have thought of this, and I spent a lot of time camping. They went up over 100 feet up the hillside from Tracy's Arm. Ordinarily, you'd camp near where your kayaks are, near where the water is. But no, they went up over 100 feet to a level area where they pitched their tents, and they awoke to this crashing sound, and they watched feet away this 100-foot tidal wave go by them. And they described it as it was a wave full of rocks, I mean, boulders the size of houses and even larger. And when the tidal wave had gone up by, causing the tsunami that then came back in and filled the bay and then went back out, areas of water that had been over 100 feet deep were now land, built up from the rock sedimentation. And all the trees that were along the side of Tracy's Arm were snapped off and gone like matchsticks. One of their kayaks was found by the Coast Guard in the top of a tree several miles away from what I was told. So it just goes to show you the unbelievable power of nature. And as I sit here talking about the unbelievable power of nature and also how just luck, if that had been 4 or 5 hours later in the day, it would have been just absolute mayhem and tremendous loss of life as cruise boats and pleasure boats came in to see the glacier as they do every day. So as I'm talking to you this morning, it's just getting light. I'm sitting on the coast of Maine, and I'm also looking at the power of nature. As the hurricane that's been moving up the East Coast has gone out to sea, but it has left behind enormous swells and waves. And for the past 3 days, the coast of New England has been pounded unrelentingly with waves based upon the hurricane that now is several hundred miles off to sea. You don't have to have a hurricane in your lap to have the consequences of a hurricane. And due to the size of this hurricane that moved up out into the Atlantic, it has left swells and waves and flooding, even though the sky has been brilliantly blue and the air is clear. Yes, there's been a bit of wind. So as it breaks dawn this morning here on the coast of Maine, I'm looking at the remnants of the hurricane this past weekend that moved up the East Coast. And it just reminds you that we are like a grain of sand on the beach when it comes to Mother Nature. She will throw us any way she wants. And whether it is the tsunami that hit Tracy's arm in Alaska, or whether it's the remnants of a hurricane that brings in 10, 8, 15-foot swells with tremendous force crashing into beaches. And all along the coast of New England, seawalls have been placed, erected in the last 20 years or so to deal with both the rising ocean and the more severity of storms and lots of erosion. And those seawalls are taking a pounding, even though the hurricane is 100 miles away and the sky is clear as can be. The sea is testing our ability to keep it back. And I can assure you, as I'm talking to you here this morning, Mother Nature is going to win. There is no seawall that's going to be erected that's going to stop the force of a hurricane or a tsunami or whatever it might be when the weather turns the way it has, both in Alaska and off the east coast of the United States in the last week. When I come back, I'm going to talk a little bit about what's going on with striped bass, which is a pretty interesting story. I'm also going to talk about lobsters, as I do each time of the year, and then I'm going to move out west quickly to the Lava Wind Farm project, which has now been stopped. I'll be back in just a moment. Thanks so much for listening. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago. First, a message from our longtime sponsors, the Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here, talking to you in the early morning hours from the coast of Maine, where, as I said, the hurricane has long moved out into the Gulf Stream, but its remnants is still delivering very high seas and treacherous conditions all along the east coast of the United States. And it just, as I said in the first part of the show, we're no match for Mother Nature. And we're reminded of that from time to time. But to think that we can control nature is, I think, pure folly. We are never going to control nature. So speaking of nature, something that changes every year and which I look forward to is what's going on in the fisheries of New England. And every year seems to be different, just as every year duck seasons are different, the migrations are different, no matter where you are. Local conditions will change things. for many, many years up and down the coast of New England. The striped bass population has been the focus of a lot of consternation as the population of striped bass goes up and down, but mostly seems to go down. And every year it's different. And here on the coast of Maine is no exception. This year, striped bass are being found in much larger schools. They're not scattered around the coast as they usually have been. Usually you can find a couple of striped bass and then move on a few hundred yards and maybe find some more striped bass. That's not what people are reporting, and that's not what I experienced. What we experienced is miles of coastline with not a bass in it. And then all of a sudden you find this enormous school of bass. And for a few minutes you might have frenetic fishing, and then it's over. Why is this happening? Why do bass seem to be schooling in much larger numbers and solitary or small, very small schools of bass, at least in the coast of Maine, southeast Maine, not seem to be occurring? There's a theory, and that theory revolves around sharks. Great white sharks are now a fairly common occurrence, sighting in areas of southern part of Maine where no one had ever seen a great white shark. And in the case of the area around Portland, Maine, the belief is that the fish schools, all kinds of fish schools, are becoming larger and more concentrated as a defense mechanism against sharks. So not only have great white sharks moved into this area, the seal population is declining significantly because the number one food source for a great white shark, well, that's a seal. But also it appears that they're changing the behavior of striped bass and bluefish, forcing them into larger schools and not so much just, if I want to use the word, they were spread out all over the coast. And now all of a sudden we're not finding that. This is just 1 year, but over the past couple of years it seems to be the case. We'll see if that trend continues, but it will tell you a lot about fish behavior, and that is if they feel threatened, they get into schools. And we'll see what happens next year. But striped bass continue to be very challenged on the east coast of America. This year, the size of striped bass would indicate that there are fewer young. A lot of larger fish are being caught. These fish can be 8, 10, 12 years old. But the fishery of New England is definitely in a state of flux. And despite the best efforts of places like Woods Hole and NOAA and all these organizations, we still don't know that much about them. We do know a bit more about lobsters. So for just the next 45 seconds, I'm going to talk about lobsters. Of course, in Maine, actually in the state's constitution, you cannot feed lobster to prisoners because they had the penal colony riots 150 or so years ago. There were so many lobsters in Maine, they just used to crawl up on the beach. And the best way to feed prisoners in the penal colonies was just to pick up the lobsters and feed it to them. Well, the people had riots because they had eaten so many lobster. Imagine that thought today. You go into a restaurant and you see market price for lobster and you know it's going to be expensive. Lobsters in southern Maine are challenged. There are fewer and fewer of them. That doesn't mean that there are fewer lobsters overall. It just means that they are changing. And as I've talked about in recent years, they are literally walking their way north. Lobsters don't swim. They don't fly. They walk on the bottom of the ocean and they are walking their way northeast up the coast of Maine and into Canada. As the waters in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, there's almost no lobster fishing left in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, because the waters have warmed over decades. So what's happening in Maine? Those lobsters are continuing to move north, and they are continuing to move further out into the ocean. They're in much deeper water than they used to be. So that also provides a bigger challenge for lobstermen because they have to go that much further. Interestingly, the price of lobster is down. And I'm also, when you go to a lobsterman, as I do here and have for many years, you go right to the wharf and they're bringing the lobster in and you can buy them right then and there. The price is a fraction. I mean, literally a fraction of what it is in a restaurant. You can buy a perfectly good lobster for $10 or $12 right off the boat. Good luck buying a lobster for $10 or $12 in any kind of restaurant anywhere in America. So it is it's great to get them fresh from the ocean. It's tough times, though, for lobstermen. Moving from the coast of Maine to a subject I wanted to discuss just briefly is Lava Ridge Wind Farm was one of the most contentious wind farms that was put forward by the previous administration, the Biden administration, to become one of the largest wind farms in America that was going to be built on public lands in the Twin Falls, Idaho area. As I mentioned a month or so ago, the Idaho delegation was 100% against it. Congressional and Senate or congressional delegation, the governor of Idaho was against it, as were most of the people in Idaho. This was a not in my backyard project, but the weakness of the project was it was going to entirely be built on federal lands. So the BLM was in charge of this. There was very strong opposition in the waning days of the Biden administration. The last permits to build the Lava Ridge wind farm were put through, and today it's been stopped. It just goes to show you how administration and politics can change. Not only is there, as you all are aware, is a move away from solar wind farms, but there is a very strong sentiment in the American West that our public lands are not going to be used for wind and solar farms to not only mar landscapes, but to really be the only place that wind and solar can be built, because so many private landowners don't want them. And the Department of Agriculture this week also said that it is not going to support any more government-subsidized wind and solar farms on America's farmland. They said that over 400,000 acres of American farmland had been taken out of production and put into wind and solar farms in the last 10 years. Now, granted, we've got several hundred thousand acres of farmland in America. But nonetheless, the tide is definitely turning. But in the case of what would have been one of the largest wind farms in the history of the world, it's not going anywhere right now. But I, unfortunately, am going to have to go somewhere in a moment. I'll be back next week with much more on the Great Outdoors. And when I do, I hopefully will have the breeding ground census and May pond counts. Yes, back in May, the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Canadian Wildlife Service did their annual survey of wetland conditions on the prairie breeding grounds. And here we are almost at the end of August, and we do not have that yet. For some reason, for a number of years now, it's been delayed later and later. And of course, it used to be that all hunting regulations were set upon what this was. Now the Fish and Wildlife Service has gone to a situation where they set the regulations years in advance. What a lot of us are wondering is what's going to happen with the effect of this year out, which appears to be really profound. Are we going to find that breeding conditions on the prairies were so bad, recruitment or the production of young birds was so limited, that the Fish and Wildlife Service is going to have to step back from the regulations they proposed and put on tighter regulations, particularly as it relates to pintail? We will find that out shortly. Thank you so much for being with me. I hope you have a great another week in the summer of August and the great outdoors wherever you are. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.